Hello there, and welcome along for another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong here in Istanbul. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and the region. Give our Facebook page a like and or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. There are show notes and links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. And please do rate or review the podcast wherever you listen to it, which really helps more people find it. Don't forget to consider becoming a Turkey Book Talk member for exclusive extras and help us keep going. Joining the esteemed ranks of signed up members gets you access to transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk as soon as the episode is published via email. You also get transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive in English, which so far amounts to over 80 conversations and which includes a number of extra interviews not previously published on the podcast. Members also get access to an exclusive discount deal, a whopping 35% off the cover price of books published in IB Taurus's extensive Turkey and Ottoman history category. IB Taurus, which is now part of Bloomsbury, has well over 400 books in its Turkey and Ottoman history series, including both academic and general interest titles. And Turkey Book Talk members receive a special code for a 35% discount on books in that series, including old-fashioned physical books, pre-orders, and ebooks. Last but not least, members also receive an archive of 231 book reviews written by myself, covering various categories including Turkish and international fiction and poetry, history, politics, journalism, the Middle East, and Europe. The archive was written over the course of 5 years and was previously available online, but now a Turkey Book Talk membership is the only way to access it. So to become a member, all you have to do is pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account. New episodes go out every 2 weeks, so the monthly membership price is no more than $6. Of course, if you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then you'll certainly be more than welcome. But so long as you pledge that $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members only get charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. But now on with our latest episode. In it, we welcome Selim Koru. He's an analyst at the Economic Policy Research Foundation of Turkey and a writing fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, for which he recently wrote a very interesting paper called The Resiliency of Turkey-Russia Relations. Now, that title may seem a bit bland, but it's actually a very stimulating article examining some of the underlying ideological similarities between the regimes in Turkey and Russia. Despite being historic rivals that are still at odds on a number of key policy issues, Ankara and Moscow, Koru argues, share a similar worldview sparked by a revisionist impulse and fundamental resentment of the West. It's this worldview that has brought Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Vladimir Putin ever closer in recent years. Indeed, the two are due to meet to discuss Syria yet again later this week, on Valentine's Day, no less. We dig deep into the roots of this shared worldview later on, but I started by asking Selim Koru to explain what triggered him to write the paper in the first place.
Well, I mean, the paper is about the roots of Turkey-Russia relations, and specifically the question I wanted to ask was, how come this relationship is so robust and Turkey's other major relationship with the sort of transatlantic alliance, if you will, has been feeling so fragile? I guess you could make an argument in a different way that relationship too is robust, but the relationship with Russia is really different, because my argument there is that it can absorb shocks a lot better. It always seems to come back after major events, because if you look at recent history, Turkey-Russia relations, it really hasn't been easy. Not a lot of countries shoot at each other's planes and have ambassadors assassinated and still come out even stronger. So the question was that. The question was, what is it about this relationship that is different from that of the West? And I came at it from also having written about another issue in Turkish domestic politics, which is the issue of resentment. So my approach to it was from that angle. It wasn't from sort of international relations literature. It was more about that. It was more about sort of political philosophy or the sort of thinking about political Islamism in Turkey rather than anything else.
And at its core, really, as you allude to there, is this idea, actually, that the two administrations in Moscow and Ankara increasingly kind of share the same worldview, and that's really what lies behind the robustness of this relationship. You say that, quote, this paper will argue that this is due to the two countries' relationship with the West, particularly the United States, rather than concrete economic or strategic gain. And the paper aims to highlight the importance of the Turkish leadership's worldview as a force that brings the countries together. Could you just kind of tease that out, this idea that it's worldview rather than interests that actually makes this relationship weather the kind of very rocky ups and downs that it's seen in the last few years?
If you taught sort of international relations literature and international relations theory, the classical stuff, you taught that more or less countries have their own sort of calculating machines that think about their interests and act accordingly, right? I mean, there's a lot of nuances to that, but it seems to me that in social science in general, that is still the dominant assumption, that at the end of the day, there's some adult who makes a calculation and decides accordingly. And the argument here is that that's not the right way to think about these things, at least not anymore, if it ever was. I make the argument that it's easier to make sense of this relationship if you think of it about the country's emotional states and the sort of the public sentiment in both countries. Of course, I don't know Russia nearly as well as I know Turkey, but I make the argument in the paper that the two countries move from a very, very similar emotional place in that regard.
And you also mentioned that, quote, this has something to do with the way the two countries perceive themselves on the global hierarchy. And Putin understands and to a significant extent actually shares Erdogan's emotional state and approaches him sort of appropriately.
Right. Well, I mean, I've been reading more and more about resentment. I mean, the argument on resentment is, or ressentiment, as people sometimes use the French word, because in the development of the theory, the writings of Nietzsche are very important, and he uses the French. His argument involves the French word, which has a slightly different connotation. I sort of got into it through Pankaj Mishra, because, I mean, we've been sort of experiencing this thing in the East, and in Turkey and Russia and a bunch of other countries. We've been, what Westerners now call populism, we've been in it for some more time. And when it started happening in the West as well, you got all this different kind of literature about it, which was exciting to me. So I started reading all these books and papers on populism that were being released. And the most interesting to me, and the one that resonated the most, was Pankaj Mishra's book, which was called Age of Anger. And in there, he makes the argument that ressentiment is almost sort of a shadow of the Enlightenment, and that as soon as the Enlightenment happens, there's also this sort of darker emotional place that begins to form. I mean, people are interested, I'd also recommend to read Laia Greenfield, who's a sociologist and who wrote on resentment as well, ressentiment. And the argument there, generally, is that once a country industrializes and mechanizes itself and develops a national identity, develops a sort of nationalistic discourse, etc., it becomes much more powerful. And then countries around it will resent it for that and start to sort of have this weird relationship towards it. So, well, Britain did it first, and then it was France, and then Germany. And in each sort of phase, you had people looking towards the industrialized, sort of nationalized country and resenting that country. The very concrete example is Germany, or German principalities looking at France, because the French are, especially with Napoleon, they have this tremendous ability to generate power, and they steamroll Europe. They conquer all these countries. And the Germans really think, wow, this is kind of disgusting but exciting at the same time. They have this weird notion of the French as being very mechanized and having sold their souls in a way, but they also want to be like them. Do you have all these notions of das Volk, you know, the people being a sort of mythical thing that has a mythical power. And the French could never understand that sort of thing. But at the same time, the Germans do it to themselves. They develop a national discourse, they industrialize, they mechanize, they unify, they do all these things to themselves. And that's a very classical case. And then as you sort of expand, you see the pattern in a lot of other countries. And in Laia Greenfield's work especially, she argues that Russia is an especially strong case of resentment for a variety of reasons, but the quality of being almost on the edge of Europe, not being as involved with these core European countries, but having your intelligentsia go back and forth and really having this weird, resentful relationship with the Franco-German as well as the British heart of Europe, that really leads to a different kind of resentment and makes resentment more important in Russian nationalism than in these other countries. And it only makes sense to extend the argument, I think, to Turkey. There isn't a whole lot of literature on that, but I mean, I definitely read something on the Ottoman Empire on resentment. That's where I was coming from also writing this piece. Because anybody who's looked at Turkish-Russian relations can feel that there is that easy synchronizing thing that these countries have. They know exactly where the other is coming from. It's very easy to just sync, to look at the world in a very similar way and talk a very similar language for these people.
And is that because there's a similar way that they both sort of measure themselves in a way against the West, or that they every advance or regression is sort of measured in terms or perceived in terms of how it will reflect in the West in a way?
Yeah, so a lot, I'm still thinking about these things. I have in no way sort of come to a very, very clear understanding of it. But there is undeniably, I think, a very strong part of it is about the reflection in the West, certainly. I'm sure you have seen it as well as anybody else who works on Turkey, that it's very important for Turks what the West thinks of them, right? There's all these even jokes about, it used to happen more often, but a lot of Turkish newspapers used to cover how Turkey was covered in the West. They said this about us. They said that about us. And those types of things are very important, even if you think the Western press and Western politicians, they're all speaking lies. It's very important to you if they said something good about you. If they said something bad about you, that is also important. You sort of see that in a different light. But all of these things are covered in Turkish media. And that in some ways puts the West especially in the center of the way you as Turkey measure yourself in the world. And that is a very tragic thing. It's also a very difficult thing to escape from, I think.
And now that we've kind of set that ground underlying this piece that you wrote, we can talk about some kind of specifics as well in relation to this, because I think that this partly explains really why, you know, people often question why don't Turkey react in the same way to Russia the way that they do to the US, for example, when Russia does something that Turkey doesn't like. So people always go on about how Russia's constantly in contact with the PKK, or, you know, there's even a YPG office or PYD office in Moscow, I believe, which there's more than it has in any other Western capital. People say, well, why does Russia get away with this and nobody else does? And I think your kind of thesis actually explains why, because it's, you know, there isn't that same focus, there isn't that same sort of measuring against Russia that there is against Germany, for example. There's no lecturing from Russia about various things, you know, so it's almost the two countries are on the same psychological space, and that makes it easier for Turkey to kind of forgive slights from Russia, for example. Hypocrisy when it comes from Russia is different emotionally than hypocrisy when it comes from the West, because Russia's not lecturing Turkey about things.
Yeah, and I'm sure if we were to ask this question to the AK Party government, or, you know, people who represent Turkish foreign policy for a living, they would say something like that. They would say, well, the Western countries, they're supposed to be our friends. We expect them to sort of, because they're our treaty allies, we expect them to look out for our interests. Whereas with Russia, it's different. We both know it's different, and we both act accordingly. Now, there is something to be said for that. But, I mean, I also wonder wonder if those people who would make that argument were entirely sure of themselves. The way I put this in the paper is I describe two ways of looking at Russia. I discuss the tension between looking at Russia as a friend of Turkey and looking at Russia as a model. And a lot of people in Turkey more recently have been interested in looking at Russia as a model. And this is part of a broader shift in Turkey's strategic culture, I've argued. Because since the Syrian civil war, there's been a shift in Turkey's strategic culture. The country had very liberal and, some might argue, naive assumptions about international politics. And now it's moving to a place where it thinks a lot more about interests and about the sort of harder aspects of international politics. And Russia, in that regard, is an appealing model to them. A country that is all on its own in the world and looks out for its interests independent of any of its allies, shall we say. And then there's Russia as the friend. Russia as a country that understands us. A country that has also been betrayed by the West, has suffered Western hypocrisy, and can be almost trusted. And these two visions of Russia, I argue, are contradictory. I mean, in my interactions with Turkish bureaucrats and people who sort of defend the current government's foreign policy and try to define the current government's foreign policy and work on it, they sort of hope that it's Russia the model. They like to act as if Turkey is not taking Russia at its word and taking its precautions. But I don't think people are quite sure about that. I think Russia the friend and Russia the model get mixed up sometimes, and it gets very blurry when it really comes to making decisions. And I think that's where things get interesting, and that's what we'll see, I think, down the line. An interesting part of that is how Turkey has been approaching Ukraine, because Ukraine might be a place where Turkey could exert pressure on Russia if it wanted to. I mean, you talk about, for example, Russia having its relations with the PYD. Perhaps Turkey could have relations with groups that Russia doesn't like. How would Turkey handle that? Would Turkey be interested in playing the same game that Russia was playing with it? Those kinds of questions would be important, I think, would be interesting to look at down the line.
And you made the point in the piece that the 2016 coup attempt in Turkey has been really crucial in sort of accelerating the relationship between Turkey and Russia. It occurred actually at a time when Turkey and Russia were only just recovering from a crisis in relations that was prompted by Turkey's shooting down of the Russian jet in, I think, November 2015. And Russia is often talked about as the first state to voice support for the Turkish government when that coup attempt was unfolding. And indeed, that coup attempt is basically framed and seen in Turkey and understood in Turkey as being basically a kind of invasion attempt, actually. And the implication is strongly that it was staged by the West to bring down Erdogan and to kind of bring Turkey to heel in a way. Just wonder if you could reflect really on how the coup attempt in 2016 tipped the balance in a way in ties with Russia.
I think it used to be that people didn't take Turkey's ideas about the Gulenists and the coup very seriously. I think people are taking those things a lot more seriously these days. So I think people understand that Turkey saw that as almost, yeah, an invasion attempt, a definite attack by the West. And when you talk to people in Ankara, especially sort of people who are close to the AK Party government, people who work in the palace and etc., that's sort of granted, you know, it's a given. You don't have to discuss those things. You don't have to think about the other person's position. Everybody sort of takes that position for granted. And the way I think of the coup these days is the way politics is going in Turkey. It's probably going to be one of the sort of big national holidays in Turkey, the big historical day, a day of great significance, the way national days in countries generally are. And you'll have national myths build on top of this day. And as with many of these things, it's very important to look at what people think happened rather than what actually happened. How people feel about the event and what kinds of stories they tell about the event. And if you look at the stories, if you look at them the way you might look at mythology, you're going to see a story about good guys and bad guys. And it's very clear who sort of the bad guys are in the story. The Gulenists and their, the Gulenists, that they have allies in the West and Western governments, and they sort of try to topple the man of the people, etc. And then there's the people who help the good guys, and the Russians are those people, right? There's all kinds of stories about how the Russians were, you know, stayed up that night. They helped Erdogan's plane arrive safely in Istanbul, and they did all these things. Some of it might be true. Who knows, right? I mean, these are governments that talk to each other. Quite a bit might be true, but it might also not be. I mean, I don't know of any reliable source, open source, that talks about these things. But the stories themselves, they're important. And yeah, so the coup attempt has that kind of significance, and the Russians definitely play a big role in that.
And those stories also have a kind of emotional resonance that makes them kind of more easy to believe in, I suppose, or more susceptible to the worldviews that we're talking about. I mean, we're talking about shared worldviews and whatnot, but there are sort of concrete results of that as well. And one of the concrete results, of course, is a partnership in energy. Russia is building a nuclear plant in Turkey and shipping gas through pipes that are going through Turkish waters. And another, of course, is security and arms purchases. One of the main practical issues that's really a saga that's been going on for months, even years, is this Turkish purchase of Russian S-400 air defense systems. It's seen as a problem because they're not compatible with NATO systems. It's one of the many issues really contributing to the big crisis between Turkey and the West that's been going on for a long time. And there's still a lot of question marks about that purchase. I'm pretty sure that by the time that this episode goes out, the issue's not going to be resolved. Just wondered how you view that purchase and how you place it in the kind of wider picture of Turkey-Russian relations and Turkey's, quote, turn away from the West.
Well, as far as I'm aware, Turkey has been interested in that purchase since 2009, so a decade. And it has gone back and forth over it. So it's not just the post-coup thing, certainly. I think it's about how you decide to think about these things. I mean, I make the argument that it's important to think about the emotional landscape because it gives you an idea of how these things are going to bend. I mean, if you're interested in policy significance, like what's going to happen with the S-400 deal, you know, what's Turkey's alliance structure going to be like down the road? There's a question to be asked. Is it important to think about the things I'm describing, which is the stories that people tell each other? Are those things important? Are the emotional things important? And the argument I make is sometimes they are and sometimes they're not, but over time they certainly are. So on the S-400 deal, I mean, is it possible that the Americans will somehow manage to sell a Patriot system to Turkey instead of the S-400? It is conceivable, certainly. But if you want to know about the relationship in the long term, why things seem to work with Russia over the long term better than with the United States or the Europeans, I think this is the way to think about it.
Yeah, and I think it's also possible to put it into a kind of broader historical perspective, really, and that is, you know, that it's probably not a coincidence that this flirtation is happening at a time when increasing numbers of people are questioning the role of NATO, and there's a kind of sense of disarray in the West among, you know, these old traditional alliances, and it shouldn't therefore probably be surprising that people on the fringe of those alliances, like Turkey, are just sort of peeling away, really. It would be odd, actually, that these circumstances being as they are, it would be odd if Turkey, you know, was the most loyal NATO member and completely wedded to this old alliance. It's probably not surprising, really, that this kind of flirtation with Russia is going on at this time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was at a lecture once, and somebody asked, I think, it was a question like, you know, if the NATO alliance structure was somehow lifted, if they somehow called it quits, what would happen? And the answer was something like, you know, the militarism that you had suppressed in all these European countries would reemerge. And then the cultures of all these countries would change again, because it used to be that in Germany, being a soldier was very important. It can into being a CEO or something, right? A high-ranking military officer was a very, very important person. The same in France and the UK. Well, the UK is a little different, but the military was a very, very important institution in all these countries. It was mandatory military service in all these countries, and it was serious stuff. It wasn't just a few weeks and you're done, or a few months, you're done. It was actually something that helped define me. And the answer was in this lecture that those things would all reemerge. And then my thinking was, when I heard that, well, that is what's happening in Turkey. Turkish strategic culture is changing very quickly, as if the NATO alliance structure had become redundant, and that as if it can't rely on this thing anymore. And you see that all across, not just the state level in Turkey. So military spending is going up and priorities are changing towards a much more security focused point of view. It's also in popular culture, which to me actually is a little more interesting. Things like how military service is perceived, what kinds of television shows people are watching. I mean, 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, if you just zap through Turkish television to see what was on, maybe you'd see a couple shows on military life or militaristic things. The vast majority was about boy and a girl, something like that. Now there's a heavy, heavy emphasis on, you know, the fight against terror, people serving the military in various ways. I think every major media group has a few of those shows now. It's almost mandatory. So that sort of transformation is happening in Turkey. The question is, as you said, it was going to happen anyways. The question is, how is it? What kind of institutional form is it going to take? I think is going to be very interesting to see.
Now, the question of Syria is very interesting, of course, when talking about relations between Ankara and Moscow, because once upon a time they were on, well, they still are, I suppose, on the opposite sides, with Turkey backing the rebels and Russia throwing its weight behind Assad. But of course, that has changed in the last few years, and there's been a kind of gradual coming round, really, of Turkey to Russia's way of thinking on Syria, which has been basically motivated by Turkey's threat perception of Kurdish militants in the north of Syria. And that sort of fits into this sort of shared emotional landscape. It's a kind of post-Cold War nationalism with a pretty heavy dose of anti-Western and sort of a rather conspiratorial way of thinking. It strikes me that when you consider that transformation, it's what we're describing is actually as being dominant in Ankara's current thinking. It's basically the kind of line of Doğu Perinçek and the Aydınlık newspaper and Perinçek's Vatan Party, and people often talk about this kind of in a throwaway sense. But I think there is something, probably, at least ideologically, there is something there. There's a quote I saw from Perinçek himself where a couple of years ago he addresses these issues and people criticizing him, saying he's basically become the government's man. And he actually said, well, I haven't moved towards the government. It's the government that's moved towards me. There's been a coming together of that worldview, and it's pretty difficult to argue against, actually.
And the thing is, when you say that Turkey has come around to Russia's point of view, I think that's a function of Turkey having been, if you look at where Turkey was at the beginning of the Syrian civil war, Turkey was terrifyingly naive when it entered that war. And it wasn't just Turkey's approach to Syria, it was Turkey's approach to foreign policy in general and to international politics in general. I mean, you have to think of the context the country was in. All these protests were happening across the Arab world, in Tunisia and in Egypt, and these Islamist governments were being elected, and the AK Party saw itself really in all these countries, in all these little revolutions. These little revolutions were happening, and they were doing overnight what the AK Party had done in Turkey over a decade, right? And the AK Party liked to think of itself as the mentor, the model, as it was called, the Turkish model of these countries. Turkey had a great relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt, of course. And when this started happening in Syria, Turkey thought, okay, another one. And this one's going to be very close to us. It's going to be an even closer relationship, even more beneficial to us. So there was this very almost ebullient approach to the whole affair. Turkey didn't think of it as entering a war, I think. People never talk of it that way. And they, especially back then, didn't talk of it that way. Turkey thought of it as just facilitating a revolution. And then it found itself engaged in a civil war in another country, a proxy war. So there was this whole rethinking to be done, right? I mean, the Syria file in Turkey was never handled by the armed forces. I mean, not never, but especially at the beginning, it wasn't handled by the armed forces. It was handled by intelligence. That tells you about Turkey's approach to it. And then, of course, Turkey saw, I think, Turkey met with reality. And there's a lot of bitterness attached to that, I think. So the Syrian civil war is the defining foreign policy learning ground for new Turkey. And it's through the Syrian civil war that new Turkey has met new Russia, if you will.
There's a quote in the piece that you wrote. It's basically, I'll quote it at length here because it's worth quoting at length. You say, quote, "Liberal observers in the West seldom take it seriously when they're portrayed as the bad guys in someone else's story, dismissing it as a cynical autocrats pandering to the masses. They're also hesitant to think that countries will forego tangible economic and security interests for the intangible things like national pride and resentment. In Turkey's case, they're wrong on both counts. Erdogan may be a pragmatic tactician, but his strategic goal comes from an emotional place rooted deep in the country's consciousness." And that strikes me as very, very true indeed. And it also strikes me that Russia under Putin is a much better psychologist, actually, than the US or the West or Europe. Putin much better understands the psychology of the Turkish government in this sense, perhaps because he shares that psychology, perhaps because he shares that worldview.
Yeah, I think the way I think of this issue is that people like Erdogan and certainly Islamists of his generation came up looking at the world as a necessarily malleable thing. If you have the feeling that you are the loser of history, right, you have a choice. You can either conform and change yourself, or you can change the world. And Erdogan certainly, and the people around him certainly wanted to see a different world, right? And he practices politics from that place. You can see that very clearly if anybody who sort of grew up watching his speeches and you know, coming up in the political tradition that he came up in knows that that is the case. It is very much about revolution. His sort of splinter group within that movement, the ingenious part of it was in realizing that maybe a revolution isn't the best way to go. Maybe you need to gradually convince people. You need to be so stubborn and not go away over a long period of time that people sort of have no choice but to conform to you. And then over time, you realize you're a revolution. And he says in his speeches that this is a revolution. We have enacted a revolution in this country. He is open about that. Whereas if you are a Western leader and you grow up in the environment you grow up, I mean, the defining stories that you come up with are World War I, World War II, especially World War II, right? If you're American or British especially. It's more about preserving the world as it is, about building on the gains of your fathers and forefathers. And maybe that's just not as compelling a place to practice politics from. I mean, that's why progressive politics is not as exciting as revisionist politics or resentful politics, whatever you want to call it.
And just to conclude, we're talking here about how people in Ankara are sort of viewing Russia as a model of independence. It's something to kind of aspire to or something to take inspiration from. And it seems like people are increasingly seeing in Russia what they want to see, really, rather than the reality. It's not really based on solid foundations, but it's based on a more emotional need, which is somehow more convincing. And you, in the paper, talk about the kind of limits of Turkey's enchantment, really, with Russia, arguing that enthusiasm is outweighing caution in Ankara. Just conclude by kind of reflecting a bit on that issue, you know, where you see it going forward and what are the dangers of this enchantment with Moscow.
Right. So for all the romanticizing of Russia and the talk of Russia, Turkey and the Turkish elite are still heavily shaped and influenced by Western ways of doing things. And if you're in the Turkish elite, you're still expected to, I mean, when you go abroad, you go to Western capitals, you don't go to Moscow, right? You learn English, you don't learn Russian. So that's a very deeply imprinted thing on Turkey, on Turkish institutions, on the Turkish psyche. And it's not something you can change from, you know, one generation to the next. That's something that changes, if it changes, very slowly over time. So that means that Turkey as a country and as a society has a very limited understanding and has a very limited feeling darling of Russia, really. So it's free to imagine onto Russia whatever it wants to imagine onto it. And there's certain stereotypes, there's certain popular conceptions, and there's, as we talked about, these stories that define the political consciousness in the country. And of course, that's largely divorced from reality. And that means that the country could be misled into thinking, into projecting something onto Russia that it wants to see, and be blind to what is actually there. So yeah, I mean, from a foreign policy perspective, if you're the sort of person who thinks about these things, who's supposed to plan about these things, it seems to me like that could be a problem. And it seems to me like the Russians would be less susceptible to this kind of problem, because they're a much bigger and much more developed country, in the sense that they have a much more developed tradition of studying other people, of having a diplomatic corps that speaks various languages, is much larger, has broader capabilities. They were an empire until very recently in history, more recently than we were. So they're much more sophisticated in their approach to other countries. So they are less susceptible to this. So it seems to me that if you are the kind of person who thinks about foreign policy in Ankara, right, and who's supposed to plan these things, there is an asymmetry that should be a problem.
That was Selim Koru. Many thanks to him. I've put up links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com to the paper we were talking about, as well as a number of Selim's other articles from over the past few years, which are all well worth having a read of or a reread. Also, if you're interested, do check out another episode on Turkey-Russia relations that we published last year. That one was with Dimitar Bechev. Remember to consider signing up as a Turkey Book Talk member if you enjoy the podcast and want to help support it. Membership gets you access to that special 35% discount on Turkey Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus and Bloomsbury, transcripts in English and Turkish of every interview as it's published, transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive of over 80 conversations, and access to an archive of 231 book reviews written by me covering Turkish history, politics, literature, and various other things. To become a member and get all that, just pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account. Also, do please rate or review Turkey Book Talk on iTunes or whatever podcast platform you use. You can follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay fully updated with new episodes. And you can send any recommendations, feedback, or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening. Gezdim dolaştım, anladım ki tek.